Deva Gauravani Pracharane Nirvasesa Nivadi Paskajade Satarane Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutapadakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitamstam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha Vanchakalpa Chubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevata Patitanam Pavan Ebyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. It's March 15th, 2023 in Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 11, Jad Bharata instructs King Rubhuna, Text 17. Bratrivyam, Bratrivyam enam tad adabravyam. Upekshaya jaditam apramata. Yahi valikam swayam atmamosham. Bratrivyam.
Bratrivyam.
The formidable enemy.
The formidable enemy. Enemies.
Enam.
Enam.
This mind.
This mind.
This mind.
Tat.
Tat.
That.
That.
Adabra viryam.
Adabra viryam.
Very, very powerful.
Very, very powerful.
Upekshaya.
Upekshaya.
By neglecting.
By neglecting.
Adyeditam. Unnecessarily increased in power.
Unnecessarily increased in power.
Apramataha.
Apramataha.
One who is without illusion.
One who is without illusion.
Guru.
Guru.
Of the spiritual master.
Of the spiritual master.
Harehe.
Harehe.
Of the supreme personality of Godhead.
Of the supreme personality of Godhead.
Sharana. Of the lotus feet.
Of the lotus feet.
Upasana ashtraha.
Upasana ashtraha.
Applying the weapon of worshipping.
Applying the weapon of worshipping.
Jahi.
Jahi.
Conquer.
Conquer.
Valik. Valikam.
Valikam.
False.
False.
Swayam.
Swayam.
Personally.
Personally.
Atma Mosham.
Atma Mosham.
Which covers the constitutional position of the living entity.
Which covers the constitutional position of the living entity.
Srila Prabhupada's translation. This uncontrolled mind is the greatest enemy of the living entity. If one neglects it or gives it a chance, it will grow more and more powerful and will become victorious. Although it is not factual, it is very strong. It covers the constitutional position of the soul. O King, please try to conquer this mind by the weapon of service to the lotus feet of the spiritual master and of the supreme personality of Godhead. Do this with great care. Srila Prabhupada's purport. There is one easy weapon by which the mind can be conquered. Disobedience. The mind is always telling us to do this or that, therefore we should be very expert in disobeying the mind's orders. Gradually, the mind should be trained to obey the orders of the soul. It is not that one should obey the orders of the mind. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur used to say that to control the mind, one should beat it with shoes many times just after awakening and again before going to sleep. In this way, one can control the mind. This is the instruction of the Shastras, of all the Shastras. If one does not do so, one is doomed to follow the dictations of the mind. Another bona fide process is to abide strictly by the orders of the spiritual master and engage in the Lord's service. Then the mind will be automatically controlled. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has instructed Srila Rupa Goswami, Brahmanda Brahmite Konya Bhagyavanji, Guru Krishna Prasade Paya Bhakti Lata Bija, C.C. Madhya 19.15. No, sorry, 151. When one receives the seed of devotional service by the mercy of Guru and Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, one's real life begins. If one abides by the orders of the spiritual master, by the grace of Krishna, he is freed from service to the mind. Thus end the Bhaktivinoda purports of the 5th canto, 11th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Jad Bharata Instructs King Rahugana. Brativyam enam tad adabravirayam upekshaya jeditam apramataha guror hares charano pasanastro jahi valikam swayam atmamosham. This uncontrolled mind is the greatest enemy of the living entity. If one neglects it or gives it a chance, it will grow more and more powerful and will become victorious. Although it is not factual, it is very strong. It covers the constitutional position of the soul. O King, please try to conquer this mind by the weapon of service to the lotus feet of the spiritual master and of a supreme personality of Godhead. Do this with great care. So every spiritual path involves gaining control over the mind. Doesn't matter which sampradaya, which religion, which... in all cases, one needs to control the mind and the body and reign with the higher self. So today we're going to look in this purport. There's basically three ways that Srila Prabhupada is describing to control the mind. So our mission, our goal for today's class is to choose one way or a combination of ways and start to put it in practice in our life. So of course the first thing we might ask is, well, why? Why should we control the mind? Many years ago, I was visiting a non-devotee school. I used to do that regularly when I was first, like 5 years that I was a teacher and a principal. I wanted to see, you know, what other people were doing and what I wanted to not do and what I wanted to do from other people's example. So I remember visiting one Waldorf school, and they had displayed artwork of their students. And one of the pieces of artwork on display said, "I follow my mind wherever it goes." And I was thinking about how, to the non-devotees, the concept of controlling the mind the way those in spiritual processes think about it is the antithesis of what they want to do. They believe that the mind is themselves. Of course, if they're really in tamagun, they think the body is themselves. But they think the mind is themselves. And they think that they should, when people say follow your heart, what they really mean generally is follow your mind. So this is a very popular saying nowadays, just follow your heart. But again, it usually means just follow the mind. And the mind is full of thoughts, emotions, and desires. Thoughts, emotions, and desires. So what is the nature of the mind? The mind and the body is very much linked. And basically, the soul is just riding, you know, there's that painting of the metaphor of the soul being the passenger in a chariot. That the chariot is the body with five horses as the five knowledge-acquiring senses, and the reins are the mind, and the driver is the intelligence, and the passenger is the soul. So for a materialistic person, the way that life works is basically as follows. So the senses engage with their sense objects. The eyes see something, the nose smells something, the ears hear something, the skin touches something, the ear hears something. And then the mind decides, the mind has this accepting, rejecting function. The mind decides if the sense object is desirable or not. Now, of course, such a decision has to be based implicitly on some kind of overall vision of good. So ideally, there's some intelligence that's decided some overall vision of good. But if the intelligence is very much materially contaminated, the only overall vision of good is let me be happy in the body and mind at the moment. And let me avoid unhappiness in the body and mind at the moment. So if the mind accepts those sense objects, then the body is flooded with some sorts of chemicals. And if the body rejects those sense objects, the body is flooded with different kinds of chemicals. So there are various chemicals, and this happens very, very quickly, that the mind is operating the brain, and the brain then releases various sorts of chemicals into the body, depending on whether the mind has decided that the sense object is favorable to one's plans or unfavorable to one's plans. And then the mind interprets then these various physical states as emotions. So these various chemicals going through the body, the mind decides, oh, that is anger, that is sexual desire, that is fear, that is shame, that is some whatever it is, according to the various chemicals. And then there are thoughts that develop in order to support those emotions. So if one feels shame, then there are thoughts about why I should feel the shame, why I should embrace the shame. Or there may be thoughts as, uh-oh, I shouldn't feel the shame. This is a bad thing. You know, there's like then a rejection. If the mind has rejected a sense object, and then the brain therefore floods the body with negative chemicals, then the mind decides that those emotions are bad emotions, and the mind will have thoughts then about trying to repress or stop those feelings. If the mind has decided that the sense objects are favorable, and then the brain floods the body with positive, so-called positive emotions, and then the mind produces thoughts to justify feeling those emotions. And of course, again, what's decided as positive or negative, the mind to accept and reject, depends on the overall vision of the intelligence. What the intelligence has decided is a goal. And for most people in Kali Yuga, the goals are fairly simple. You know, just basically to try to enjoy the senses and the mind as much as possible. And then according to these thoughts and feelings, there comes desires and will. Thinking, feeling, willing, there comes action taken. So this is basically how it works. And some people say it works in a little bit another way. Some people posit that there's sense objects and the mind accepts and rejects them, as we were saying, but that the thoughts come first and then the feelings. That's not likely. However, sometimes the sense objects are the thoughts. So sometimes the sense objects are internal. In other words, you can be, you know, sitting outside or sitting in your room and there's no particular sense objects that engage your senses, but your thoughts can meander to something in the past or in the future, and that acts as if you were contacting those sense objects in the present. So sometimes it works like that. Sometimes the sense object is something imagined in the mind. And then again, if the mind then accepts that sense object, which isn't always the case, like one may imagine some fearful thing and be afraid of it, you know, the mind then rejects that, then the brain floods the body with the negative chemicals, which produce something that we call an emotion, fear or anger or whatever, and then there are thoughts which arise to support that particular emotion, and then from there comes desire. So that's basically how the whole thing functions. Now, we can understand from this description that the soul is just kind of this helpless servant of the mind. It's something like having an untrained animal. And in fact, that comparison is given in the Bhagavad Gita. It's something like having an untrained animal that's just pulling you around here and there. You know, like somebody gets on a horse, they don't know how to ride the horse, they don't know how to control the horse, and the horse just takes them where it wants to go. Or when I was 9 years old, I broke my arm because of my father's dog. So I had the job every day after school of taking my father's dog for a walk. And the dog was supposedly trained, but somehow or other It didn't listen to me. Maybe it listened to my father, but it really didn't listen to me. So I was taking the dog on a walk. We were going downhill, and the dog started running and pulling on the leash. And I was just pulled along by this dog. And then all of a sudden, the dog decided to stop, and it stopped right in front of me. And so I tumbled over the dog, and I fell on my left arm and broke it. And then I had to switch the leash to my right arm, but I couldn't get up because I couldn't use my left arm as leverage, and I couldn't use my right arm as leverage because I was holding the leash. And my parents weren't home. It took like 2 hours before some older kids got home from school on another bus and found me and helped me up and so forth. So, but this is what happens. You know, we have the uncontrolled mind. It's like a wild animal. And we break our bones. We get into trouble. We end up doing things that we regret. And this is, of course, Arjuna's question. Why do we do things that we know are wrong? I think this is like one of the biggest questions that a conditioned soul asks is, why do I say and do things that I know are wrong? And I know I'm going to regret in 2 minutes or, you know, at least in an hour or whatever. I know that it's something I don't want to do. It's something I don't want to be. And the reason for that is simple. We're controlled by the mind. So we have to control the mind. All right. Sounds very simple. And Prabhupada starts out with easy. Now, it's interesting. In the purport that you have here, it says the one easy weapon is neglect. That's true with the copy that I have on my phone, but the copy that I have on my database says disobedience. So I think that this is some posthumous editor that changed it from neglect to disobedience. And I can understand why, because Prabhupada uses the word neglect in the translation in a negative way, so why would he use it in the purport in a positive way? However, such is certainly possible. And this neglect and disobedience are practically synonymous. But I do like the word neglect, and Prabhupada uses that elsewhere. So the first method is neglect or disobedience. The second method is beating, which Srila Prabhupada quotes Srila Bhakti Siddhanta here. And the third method is the weapon of worship, which I really like here, upasana astraha. Astra is a weapon. And upasana means to worship, so the weapon of worshiping. So I thought that was really cool. Guru, Harer, Chana, the Guru and Krishna, their feet, the weapon of worshiping. So let's look at each of the three of these. Each of these three work, and they can work singly or they can work in combination. And the two of these methods, neglect or disobedience and beating, are also used in other forms of yoga, and the weapon of worship of the Guru and the Supreme Personality of Godhead is particularly used in bhakti, although of course in other forms of yoga they also have a Guru. So let's look at this disobedience or neglect of the mind. Now, the way neglect is talked about in the translation in a negative way is where you just let the mind have free rein. You can think of it as you know, like there's criminal child neglect kind of thing. But that's not what we mean. We mean by neglect in the translation, to give it a chance, is to just let it run wild, to just let it go wherever it wants. In other words, to neglect to train it in any way. So you see this with, you know, some children are like this. Their parents have never given them any kind of training, any kind of instruction. I mean, there was one person in the Hare Krishna movement who would say that until a child's five, that you should just let them do whatever they want. And I said, well, Mother Yasoda sure didn't do that with Krishna. I said, you wouldn't like your child very much if you did that and no one else would want you around. So this idea with the mind that you just completely let it go wild. And materialists, again, they tend to do this to one degree or another. And that's not what we mean. By neglect, we mean that one neither feeds it or hates it. And this point Prabhupada calls this easy. He calls it an easy weapon. And once you understand it, it's extremely easy. But what I find is that generally people don't understand it. They think that disobedience to the mind means repression. It does not mean repression. And I like the word neglect that's in some of the purports. That you just don't feed it. I mean, it. You know, with a child, that would be criminal. You just don't, like, feed the child. You don't clothe it. You don't bathe it, you know, and the child dies out of neglect. But with the mind, that's exactly what we want to do. We want to neglect it. You know, if you think about in our social dealings, like sometimes there may be people in our lives who are just trouble and we don't really want to interact with them. At the same time, socially, we may not be able to just cut them out of our lives for a variety of reasons. But we don't have to be responsive. You know, we just, oh, okay, yeah, yeah, all right. Yeah, that's interesting. Actually, there's a book I read a long time ago, Don't Shoot the Dog, about 8 different ways to change bad behavior. And one of them is called extinction, that you just don't pay any attention to it. And the author was talking about how her mother would regularly call and complain about things. And she said what she started to do is when her mother would complain, she just basically wouldn't give much of a response. She would just say, oh, or uh-huh. And if her mother would talk about nice things, then she would respond. And gradually her mother stopped complaining because she wasn't getting any response. And that's this disobedience of the mind. This concept of being free of attachment and aversion for the thoughts and the feelings of the mind is, again, it's all over the Shastra. Okay, now this is how it's done. So again, we have this kind of cascade that the senses interact with sense objects, whether they're in the external world or whether they actually originate in the mind from something in the past or imagined in the future. And from that produces chemicals, which produce what we term materially as emotions. And from that produces thoughts. So the senses interacting with the sense objects is not something that is possible to stop unless you do Dhyan Yoga and you go to the forest and you just stare at the tip of your nose. Right? But even then, like Lord Shiva, where he meditates, there's no birds in the tree. You know, but even if you're meditating, we have, like, Bharat Maharaj in his previous life, he got distracted by a deer. We have Vishramrita got distracted by jewelry. I mean, you know, it's kind of hard to withdraw, to do Pratyahara absolutely, where the senses have absolutely nothing to do with their sense objects. All right. So that means that some emotions will arise. And in fact, later on in this story, Jed Bharata is described as having felt some waves of dissatisfaction at the insults of King Rahugana. But Prabhupada says he neglected them. So there will be some interaction between the senses and the sense objects, which will trigger this cascade of either positive, what we would call positive, or what we would call negative chemicals flooding the body. It's at this stage, in this method, where one remains neutral. One takes the stance of a neutral observer and just says, oh, there's guilt in my body, there's anger in my body. And one neither embraces it or tries to kill it. One simply leaves it alone. Now remember, the next thing in the cascade are the thoughts that either support the emotion and try to feed it, or the thoughts that try to kill it. And so one just ignores these thoughts entirely, as if they were things spoken by someone else at a distance and have nothing to do with oneself. One ignores the thoughts and one simply allows the feeling. The way the body is programmed is these sort of chemicals will come in the body, and then they will, if not acted upon, either to embrace them or to repress them, if they're ignored completely, they will dissipate very quickly, generally within about 1.5 minutes. And they kind of build up and then they dissipate. And one just observes that, like a wave in the ocean. You know, Krishna talks about in 270, rivers going in the ocean. One just observes that and lets it go. In fact, one can even kind of lean into it and say, okay, I allow this feeling to be in my body. As long as it wants to stay, it can stay. You know, it's kind of like if you're sitting down outside and some bird flies next to you, you know, and you're just sitting there, and the bird can stay as long as it wants to stay. You don't try to pick up the bird. It'll peck you, and you don't shoo the bird away. You just go on with your business, and the bird can stay or go as long as it likes. You know, or even another person. You go to a park, and some person sits down in another bench, and you do your business, and that person can stay as long as they like, and they can go when they like. So one hits at the level of the emotions. That just one lets the emotions stay or go as they like without paying them much attention. One may just note, oh, there's this emotion in the body, and completely ignores the thoughts. So that is the first method. And it is Prabhupada calls it a very easy method. It's certainly easy once you learn how to do it. And the more you, like anything else, the more you practice it, the easier it is. It may not be easy at first because we're accustomed to something else. We're accustomed to identifying with those chemicals as if they are the way that we feel, and then we're accustomed to identifying with the thoughts as if they are the way we think. And so it takes a little bit of practice, and sometimes, often, the first step is just noticing that one is doing that. One is just noticing, oh, you know, I'm identifying with this emotion. I'm identifying with this thought. Well, look at that. And I'm then acting according to that. But once one learns to step back like that, then it becomes, as Prabhupada calls it, an easy method. All right. So the next thing is beating. So this is a little bit different. So the neglect or disobedience is on the level of the we do on the level of the emotions and leave the thoughts alone. On the level of beating, we are actively challenging the mind's thoughts, not the feelings, the thoughts. So in the disobedience, we're hitting on the feelings, and on the beating, we're hitting on the thoughts. So this is also a relatively easy method, and again, often misunderstood, that people think that beating the mind means repression. And please remember that attachment and aversion are the same. They're not different. Attachment and aversion are the same. Aversion is not the goal whatsoever. It's detachment, not aversion, not repression or suppression. So the techniques for beating the mind with sticks and shoes is to challenge the thoughts of the mind. And in order to do this, one needs to understand the four defects of a conditioned soul. That we make mistakes, we are illusioned, and we cheat, and we have imperfect senses. And the main person we cheat, of course, is ourselves. So I have imperfect senses. So this means that what my senses have perceived in the first place is likely to be mistaken. So my initial objective perception, what I think I've seen, what I think I've heard, what I think I've smelled, what I think I've touched, may be different than what actually happened. And we all have experience of this. We think we see something and it's something else. We think we hear something and it's something else. And what's really interesting, and my granddaughter and I have noted this many times, is that when we hear something different than what someone said, our mind tries to make sense out of our mishearing. Instead of assuming that we misheard. Anyway, so that's the first step, that I may not even be getting in objective information in the first place. Then the next thing is I'm illusioned, and I cheat, and I make mistakes, which means that even if I'm getting objective information, I'm not really looking at the information objectively. I'm looking at how I'm interpreting the information. What story am I telling me about the information? What does it mean? What meaning am I assigning to it? Somebody bumps into me, am I assigning the meaning that they did that on purpose because they hate me? Or am I assigning the meaning that they tripped and they just bumped into me accidentally? What meaning am I assigning to it? Somebody says they'll write me back tomorrow and they don't. Do I figure, you know, they got sick? Do I figure they forgot? Do I figure that they hate me and they're not? What meaning do I put on this? And what most of us do is we assume that the interpretation is the objective fact. A, we think that we are taking in objective facts, which generally we are not. Our senses are imperfect. B, we conclude that the story I tell myself about the objective facts is the same as the objective facts. Which any 2-second deliberation would show us that this is ridiculous. 10 people can be in the same place at the same time experiencing exactly the same objective facts and come away with 10 different interpretations of the meaning of those facts. We all know that. We've all gotten into misunderstandings and miscommunication with people where the other person or person's understanding of what transpired and our understanding is radically different. And sometimes diametrically opposed. And it's not always innocent because we have a cheating propensity. So because we have a cheating propensity and because the main person that we cheat is ourselves, we are very, very likely to interpret objective facts to serve what we think is our interests. Which may not be our interest, but we're very, very likely to do that. Extremely likely to do that. So it could be an innocent mistake or an innocent illusion, or it could be a deliberate cheating that we may not even be consciously aware of. So this beating the mind is, I challenge this. I challenge it. There was a book I read a long time ago called The Innocents, and it was about people who'd been accused of crimes and later exonerated, later found to be innocent, and given an official pardon by the government. And a fourth of the cases were on eyewitness testimony. That people were sure, they were absolutely sure, that's the person who committed the crime. And they were wrong. They were just wrong. One of the cases was interesting. It was in North Carolina, which is where I am now. And there were 4 women who were in jail in 4 different counties for the same crime, and none of them was the actual criminal. All of them were short and fat. And when the actual criminal was apprehended, then the other 4 ladies were released. Another interesting crime was where there were eyewitnesses, but the people had an alibi hundreds of miles away, and it ended up that they weren't at the crime scene at all. This is just not unusual. Right? I mean, our stories may be wrong. So this beating the mind, we have some thought, and we ask ourselves, is this thought true? Am I sure it's true? So-and-so didn't write me back because they just don't like me and they're trying to avoid me. Am I sure it's true? Or let's say we're sure it's true. So-and-so told me this and I found out they lied to me. Is it true? I say, yeah, it's true. All right, then the next question is it the absolute truth? And 99 times out of 100, the answer to that will be no. This particular thought, first of all, may not be true. I may not even be sure that it's true. And second of all, even if I'm sure that it's true, is it a representative of what's absolutely true? I generally, no. I challenge it. Is my thought about something that's the absolute truth? Or is my thought about some relative truth, or I don't even know it's true? And then I ask myself, okay, suppose that I choose to believe this. How do I feel? What does that do for me in my life? I mean, a very clear example here is King Rahugana and Jed Bharata. The King Rahugana, you know, his palanquin is shaking. And that's his objective experience. Palanquin shaking. It's an objective experience from his senses. His mind decides that this is bad, which then his brain floods his body with stress chemicals. So he's feeling angry and irritated. Then he has thoughts about it. He interprets it. This person doesn't respect me. This person is shaking my palanquin out of disrespect, even though I'm the king and they're just some stupid person. Right? But what happened when he accepted that as that that's absolutely true? He was more angry. He was more irritated. He was unhappy. So you ask yourself, if I accept this thought as true, what happens? How do I feel? Where does it take me? What kind of person do I become when I accept these thoughts as the absolute truth? Do I become fearful? Do I become angry? Do I become vengeful? Do I become guilty? And suppose I just was incapable of having this thought. How would I feel? And the answer is often, well, I feel free and happy. And then you're like, why do I want to have this thought? So this is beating the mind. You challenge it. Think of it like, you know, a lawyer in a court with a witness. And the witness comes and says, I saw this person do this. And you're the fiery lawyer. Like, I don't know, when I was a kid, I used to watch Perry Mason on TV. You know, you're the fiery lawyer. And you go, are you sure you saw that? Are you sure it's the truth? And if we believe that, what does that mean? That means an innocent person's going to go to jail. And if we don't believe it, what does it mean? It means that this person's going to be free. And so you ask your mind this. Is this true? Is this the absolute truth? If I believe you, my dear mind, if I follow this thought, where am I going? And if I choose to ignore you, and if I choose to say, hey, this I'm not going to have anything to do with this, then where do I go? And then there's more advanced levels of the speeding the mind as well, which we don't have time to get into today. All right, then the third one is, as Jed Barth is so beautifully putting this, Gurur Harer Chedana Upasana Astra, the weapon of worshipping the feet of Guru and Krishna. So this is a positive engagement for the thinking, feeling, and willing of the mind. And in bhakti, even if we do the other two, even if we do the neglect / disobedience, or we do the beating, and certainly we can, it's not that we should only do the third one, although you could only do the third one, but it's not that in bhakti we don't do the others. Just because the others are generally done in the other forms of yoga doesn't mean we don't also do them. Prabhupada's telling us to do it. Srila Bhakti said, I'm just telling us to do these other ones. It's not that they're outside of bhakti just because they're done in other yogas. But to give the mind positive engagement. And that's not a difficult thing to explain. Give the mind positive engagement. You have a disobedient child, give them something positive to do. In the eight ways of changing behavior, the best one is to find what's driving the bad behavior and instead find some good behavior that can have the same driver. Just like there are some people who are constantly criticizing management in terms of ethics, morality, justice, why don't they get in a position where they can work positively for ethics and morality and justice? They're probably just frustrated kshatriyas. At least some of them. Get a positive engagement for the mind. Prabhupada talks about this as far as conquering lust. He said, use this same tendency. Instead of making plans for sense gratification, make plans for preaching Krishna consciousness. I mean, because Sri Chaitanya has this movement to take over the world, plans for preaching Krishna consciousness, what Prabhupada says, they're not narrow or stereotyped. One can literally have millions of positive plans for preaching Krishna consciousness that can fully engage the thinking, feeling, and willing of the mind in positive ways. And that just isn't such a hard thing to understand. Now, one may have to do these in tandem, especially if there's very, very strong harmful thoughts and feelings So one may do the disobedience and the higher engagement, or the beating and the higher engagement, or the disobedience, beating, and higher engagement. One may have to do all of them. Or at least combine the higher engagements with one of the other two. Because sometimes the mind is so disturbed that it refuses to do a higher engagement. And one can hit the higher engagement on any thinking, feeling, and willing, and hopefully all three. One can do active things with the body and hope that the mind will follow. I find sometimes that works, sometimes that doesn't. It depends how involved the active thing I'm doing is with the body. If I'm doing something very mechanical with the body, then the mind doesn't necessarily follow. The mind's doing something else while the body's doing something very mechanical. But one can do it on the platform of the body. One can do it on the platform of thoughts. One can think about, let's do this service and that service for Guru and Krishna. And one can do it on the platform of emotions. And I've said this before, Prabhupada talks about a technique where we take the emotions that we're experiencing materially and we find some similar emotions from Leela. Because after all, those are the original emotions. It has to be emotions of Krishna or a pure devotee. Please don't pick emotions of a demon. And focus on that and meditate on that. And then naturally the material emotions recede. It's a very, very powerful process, though it can only be practiced by those who are familiar with the Shastra. I mean, sometimes that can be as simple, like if I'm busy physically with something that doesn't take a lot of mental focus, and so my mind is likely to wander here and there to whatever, then I'll listen to something while I'm busy. I'll listen to one of Srila Prabhupada's lectures, or I really like listening to audiobooks. You know, that Prabhupada's books as audiobooks or books of the Acharyas as audiobooks, and then get very absorbed in that, in those leelas. Right now I'm listening to the Mahabharata, and one gets absorbed in those leelas, and then even at the time that one is not listening, then one will remember those again and again. And so that is not a difficult way to change the mind. And this technique really depends on reading and hearing. It can't be done without reading and hearing. Although one can also engage the thinking, feeling, and willing in the practical missionary work. But at least in my experience with most people, we also need to hear the Shastra. We need to hear from Srila Prabhupada. We need to hear from our Acharyas. Just keeping ourselves physically busy in the mission and trying to think about the mission, it doesn't seem to be sufficient. We really do, at least this is what I see for the majority of people. So in this way, we can actually control the mind. Will we be perfect 100% of the time tomorrow? Probably not. I mean, we have examples in the Shastra of even very great personalities, certainly a lot greater than I'm ever going to be in Kali Yuga, that, you know, messed up. Dhruva Maharaj messes up with the Yakshas. Parikit Maharaj messes up with Shamakarishi. I mean, they mess up. They have a slip here and there. So if such great personalities are going to have a slip here and there, so it's, you know, Jed Bharat, who messed up as Bharat with the deer, that was a pretty big mess up. So, you know, these things, they happen. And we shouldn't put pressure on ourselves that we have to be perfect. That's another kind of craziness of the mind. But we should certainly practice, and we should get to the point where the vast majority of the time, in the vast majority of situations, we are controlling the mind rather than the mind controlling us. And again, it's not repression, it's not repression, it's not aversion, it's not repression, it's not aversion, it's not repression, it's not aversion. That is not controlling the mind. That is just the other side of attachment. It doesn't get us where we want to go at all. In fact, it gets us the opposite of where we want to go. And then if people try to control the mind with aversion and repression, then they will say things like, I've been practicing Krishna consciousness for a long time and I still get, you know, overcome by things frequently. To get overcome by things occasionally is life. But to get overcome by things frequently, then we're doing something wrong. we should be able to stay fixed on this platform of controlling the mind. So that is if we want to be happy. Without controlling the mind, there's no peace. And as Krishna says, we can't have happiness without peace. And we then function on the spiritual level. So we've looked at three different ways of controlling the mind that Prabhupada talks about. The first, depending on which purport, which version of the purport you're looking at, Prabhupada calls it disobedience or neglect. This is where we just don't pay any attention to the thoughts and we leave the feelings alone. We let them come and go as they please without indulging in them or repressing them. The other is beating, where we actually do take the thoughts and challenge them. We challenge their truthfulness and we challenge their whether or not they're beneficial for us. So we ask ourselves, is this thought true? And if we say yes, we say, well, are we absolutely sure it's true? Is it the absolute truth without any doubt? And then we say, what benefit do I get from this thought? Does it actually benefit me? How does it make me feel? How does it make me act when I have this thought? And how would I feel and act if I was incapable of having this thought? Is there benefit there? And that way we can move back from the thoughts, which then disengages the emotions. So that's beating the mind. And the last is to use this weapon, and I really like this analogy of a weapon, to use this weapon to conquer the mind by engaging the mind in something higher, Paramjusvanivartite. So if we can practice these methods, they're practicable. Prabhupada says, use the word easy. So they're practicable. They're things that we can do. Again, we'll probably not do them perfectly in the next 5 minutes, but we can certainly do them, we can certainly advance. And often the beginning of practice, I say this a lot, but it bears repeating, it's just knowing how we're messing up, just starting to notice how we're messing up, just starting to be aware. That's a huge step. Instead of just blindly being carried around by the thinking, feeling, and willing of the mind, to just become aware and step back and go, wow, I'm being blindly carried around by the mind. That's huge. So just doing that is something. All right, questions, comments, additions, subtractions?
Oops. Okay, I'm working on it.
Okay, Vijayakrishna, you want to pick up something that I did not talk about at all in the class. It's in the purport, but I didn't talk about it. When one receives the seed of devotional service, when real lives begin, what is the difference between real life and fake life? Real life is I'm identifying as the soul and the servant of Krishna, and fake life is I'm identifying as the body and the mind. That's the simplest.
Thank you, Mother Rumila. Thank you very much.
Sure, that's the simplest answer. There is a more in-depth, detailed answer, but I did not pick up on that because it wasn't the main point here. You know, with every verse and purport, I've concluded there's at least 200 different themes that one could pick up, so that was not one that I...
Thank you, Mother Rumila.
Sure.
I have a quick one for you.
Yes.
I couldn't understand what you said at the beginning about in one version it says neglect, and the other it said something else, and one was positive, was negative. They went right over my head.
Okay. In the purport that you put up on the screen, the first sentence ends with the word neglect. If you go to the Vedabase online, you will also find that, which is probably what you're pulling from. The first sentence ends with the word neglect. In the Vedabase I have on my computer, the first sentence ends with the word disobedience. So an editor most likely changed it from neglect to disobedience. It's possible it was changed from disobedience to neglect, but I think it went the other way. Why do I think that? If we look at the translation, you'll notice that the second sentence has the word neglect in it. And the second sentence of the translation has the word neglect as a bad thing. So Jed Bharata is talking about neglecting the mind as something bad, that you should not neglect the mind. In the first sentence of the purport, Prabhupada's talking about neglect as something good. My personal belief is that some editor looked at this and said, oh, this is confusing. In the translation, it says, don't neglect the mind. And in the purport, Prabhupada's saying, neglect the mind. So Prabhupada really meant disobey the mind. So we're going to change neglect to disobedience.
Okay, now I understand. Thank you.
Thank you for communicating to me that I was unclear.
In order to control the mind, it seems like one of the first things we have to do is to recognize it. Sometimes the mind can disguise itself as the intelligence.
Yes.
Just like the Palumbasura, who made himself just look like just one of the cowherd boys, and they got accepted by even Balaram. I think was a little confused, and he kind of snookered Balaram a little bit. Balaram didn't know that he was carrying, a demon rather than one of the cowherd boys. Eventually, he figured it out. At least that's how I remember it. So how do we recognize? Because the minds are very clever.
All right. Well, thank you. That's a good question, because as I was saying, often the first step is just recognizing what's going on. And people get very discouraged by that. So, the four steps of learning everything are unconscious incompetence, conscious incompetence, conscious competence, and unconscious competence. So to go from unconscious incompetence, where their mind's pulling you around and you have no idea what's going on, the first step is conscious incompetence. The mind's still pulling you around, but you become aware of it. Becoming aware of it means, in and of itself, having a kind of separation between yourself and the mind. And to distinguish between the mind and the intelligence makes overall plans. The intelligence is the visionary. The intelligence is the voice of the intelligence is called Pasyantivak, the speech of vision. Like if you're going to start a project, the first thing you have is a vision before you collect money. I say to people, if you want to start a project or a business, what's the first thing you do? And people say collect money. I said, no, first thing is you have a vision. You have some kind of goal. So the intelligence sets the overall goal, the overall purpose. So for some people, the overall purpose is to be an animal, to just enjoy the senses and the mind. I mean, if that's on a really low level, then they've actually become criminals. A little higher than that is to become an animal but not get into trouble in human society. So, basically just enjoy the senses and the mind, but do it in such a way that I'm not going to go to jail. My family isn't going to leave me, try to behave at least kind of like, a pet dog where it's afraid of them. It's still a dog, but because it's a pet dog, it has some fear of the master. So sometimes that's the intelligence. So that's very much in Tamagun. And then in Rajagun, one has a vision that I want to help society and I want to uplift society and I want to be righteous and I want to be a good person because that way I'll be recognized and appreciated in society and I'll be the doer and I'll make a change in the world. And then in Sattvagun, the intelligence is, let me be a balanced and harmonious spiritual person, who's acting in harmony with the earth and with all living beings and maybe even with God. So that's the intelligence. And the mind is the thinking, feeling, and willing. So again, the mind, the steps again, is that first the senses interact with the sense object. That's the first step. Sometimes those sense objects can be in the mind itself. If I'm thinking about how someone insulted me last week, then it's as if that person was standing in front of me insulting me now. Do you follow?
I do.
Okay. So the brain isn't distinguishing. The brain doesn't distinguish at all whether Joe Schmo is standing in front of me yelling at me or I'm remembering Joe Schmo standing in front of me yelling at me. So that's the first step. There's some kind of sense object. Or, if there's a cake in front of me or I'm thinking about a cake, that doesn't matter. So the first thing is a sense object, either imagined or actually in the world. That's the first step. It's physical. The next step are what we call the emotions, the brain chemicals. Actually, the very, very next step is the mind's accepting and rejecting. So the mind decides, is this sense object favorable or unfavorable according to my intelligence? According to the plan of the intelligence. Is Joe Smo yelling at me, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And it's good or bad according to our vision of intelligence. And this happens very quickly. So if the mind decides it's a good thing, then the brain floods us with the the chemicals that we associate as happy emotions. And if the mind decides it's a bad thing, the brain floods us with the chemicals we associate as bad emotions, unhappy emotions. Then the mind creates thoughts to support those feelings. If there are what we call good emotions, the mind usually creates thoughts as to how we should get into those and how we should feed those emotions and act on them. And if it's something that the mind has decided are bad feelings, then the mind usually tries to get us to repress them or suppress them. So just see this. It's a particular cascade that goes on. And just start noticing it. You know, oh, I see this thing, I hear this thing, I smell this thing. My mind does this accepting, rejecting. And then there's a corresponding feeling in my body. And there's actually a feeling in one's body. And then there's thoughts that go along with that feeling.
The more the mind becomes purified, I would suppose, or trained, it gets a little difficult, if not impossible, to distinguish between the mind and the intelligence when they're actually, when the mind gets, you know, when the mind actually becomes our best friend, as Krishna says.
Well, it still has a different function. The mind still has a different function from the intelligence, but it's functioning in, the mind's always functioning in congruence with the intelligence. Sometimes the intelligence just sort of abdicates to the senses. That's like the lowest level of animal life, you know, which would be in human society criminality. So if the mind just abdicates, if the intelligence just abdicates to the senses, the intelligence says, my plan is to do whatever feels good at the moment. Never mind consequences. You know, then the senses and the intelligence are practically identical, but the mind's always the servant of the intelligence, always. If the intelligence is abdicated to the senses, then the mind and the senses are practically the same. But it's always following the intelligence. So if the intelligence is, what as Krishna says, you know, if we've conquered the intelligence, then the super soul is already reached. So if your intelligence is congruent with the desires of Guru and Krishna, and the mind is following that, then everything is in harmony. Then it becomes a fully integrated system. And the mind is one's friend. The mind will still sometimes do funny things. As I was giving these examples, I mean, even Jed Bharat in this life, his mind gave him waves of dissatisfaction from these insults. The mind will still do funny things sometimes. The modes of nature are there. Prabhupada very nicely explains this in his purport to Gita 14:22-25. Don't think you're going to get the mind to be always your friend. Forget it. Like, forget it. Therefore, there's that verse, I forget which verse it is, I think it's in the section of the Bhagavatam, maybe with Rishabhdev, that one should think about the mind as a wild animal, that you never fully trust it. You never say, oh, now I've, you know, now my mind is totally tame. You know, there's all these verses about even, what does Krishna say in the second chapter? Even a wise person can be disturbed by one of the senses. You know, even a learned person shouldn't be alone with a sister or daughter. You know, why are these things there? Because you can't absolutely trust that the mind isn't going to be carried away at least a little bit here and there. You know, that's generally the case. I mean, you have, it's interesting, Maharaj Yudhisthira, when his mother said, share the alms, and Yudhisthira was looking around and seeing that all the Pandavas were attracted to Draupadi, and he concluded that they should all marry her. And one of his evidences, he said, my mind only goes to Dharma. I mean, it's kind of interesting, because then you have the gambling match, which Yudhisthira engaged in out of obedience to the king and obedience to Kshatriya Dharma. But, you know, he didn't have to gamble away his brothers and his wife. Just because he had to play the game doesn't mean he had to, you know, stake his whole kingdom and his whole treasury. He could have played a round or two with some simple stakes and then walked away and still been in obedience to the king and to the Kshatriya code. So, you know, even Yudhisthira, I think he kind of messed up there. And his, certainly his brothers and his wife all agreed that he kind of messed up. I mean, obviously, it was in Leela, and, you know, there's the Leela factor there. But the example is there. So one shouldn't trust the mind. One shouldn't think, oh, now I'm such a great yogi and such a great devotee that whatever I think and feel is absolutely the same as Krishna consciousness. Risky.
Great point. Thank you so much. Well, very well said.
Thank you. Okay. Yes, we'll take this and then we should end. Yes, how may I serve you?
Okay. So, very nice class. This was implied in some of your explanations, but mindfulness, becoming a witness, an observer, has become very popular.
Yes.
In some ways, and the 270 verse, person who's not disturbed
yes.
by the incessant flow of desires.
Yes, absolutely.
The nature-like rivers into the ocean.
Absolutely. I mean, these first two techniques, and to some extent the third one, as I said in the beginning, are used by all spiritual practitioners, regardless of the sampradaya or even the religion. So they're absolutely.
And you got to detach yourself. Understand that the mind is not you.
Yes.
Exactly. It's right.
Exactly. So whether whether someone's doing karma yoga, gyan yoga, or dhyan yoga, whether they're a Vaishnava or they're an impersonalist or they're a Buddhist or they're a Christian or they're a Muslim or they're a Jew or whatever they are, if they're actually practicing their religious spirituality, there'll be some practice like this in there. I mean, in some case, it becomes kind of lost and forgotten for the general followers of the religion, but it's there. You know, you'll find it in the scriptures, you'll find it in their teachers, and there's been a big interest in, at the present time, in aspects of Gyan Yoga and Dhyan Yoga. You know, there is a huge interest in it, especially people are interested in it without religion. So they're interested in one of these two techniques, in disobedience to the mind and beating the mind. Both of those are very, very popular methods that people are learning just to become happy and peaceful and healthy. And there's people making millions of dollars with their books and their courses teaching these things. So they're studied by people who don't have any interest in God at all, just to try to be happy and healthy in the world. So there's a big interest. And it's an area that we can tap into in our preaching, just like so many people are interested in kirtan, and so we can engage them in Krishna kirtan. So many people are interested in controlling the mind, separating themselves from the mind, either through some process of gyan or through some process of dhyan, or sometimes a combination of the two. But these things are also included in bhakti in their highest form. And we have a positive engagement for the mind. Just doing the first two without a positive engagement is a lot harder. I mean, it can be done, but it's a lot harder. As Krishna says, klesho dikkhacharastasyam. But yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for bringing that up. I think it's very important. I mean, there's a thing I teach called environmental scanning, which has nothing to do with ecology. But it's about, as preachers, noticing what's going on in the world, noticing what's going on in our environment, and tailoring our presentation of Krishna consciousness and our preaching in such a way that people will be receptive according to where they're at, what's going on. This is one of the items of knowledge, is to preach according to time, place, and circumstance. So there's a huge, huge interest in this topic in the world right now. Huge. There's at least as much interest in this topic as in the yogic asanas. So devotees are, teaching hatha yoga classes as a kind of preaching, but this stuff is also, it's major.
It's an on-ramp.
It is definitely an on-ramp. and it is very much a part of bhakti, whereas hatha yoga is not really so much a part of bhakti. But this is. I mean, learning how to control the mind is definitely a major part of bhakti. And it's something that people are interested in. They are buying books about it. They are spending hundreds or thousands of dollars for courses on it. It's become, you know, buzzwords out in the society in general. So, yeah, why don't we say, hey guys, you know, we do this and we've got a superior method of it.
Right.
We've got something that goes beyond neutrality. You know, the best that they're going to achieve is going to be Brahma-Bhuta. It's going to be, you know, realization of Brahman. That's the best they're going to get. Maybe somebody's going to get Paramatma. I met one Buddhist teacher of Vipassana who had a Paramatma experience while doing these kinds of meditations. But generally the best they get is Brahman, and that's even rare. Most people can't become that skilled. So, hey, what about absorbing your mind intelligence, you know, mind desires, thinking, feeling, willing, and bhakti? Woohoo! That's a lot better. I'd rather play with Krishna in the forest of Vrindavan than just hang out in the Brahman forever, you know. Yeah? Everybody?
Yeah. Same. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody on board with that?
Sure.
Anybody just want to hang out in the Brahman?
Yes.
All right, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.
Thank you.
Jai. Thank you.